From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I'll speak with jazz flugelhornist Art Farmer. Also today, I'll talk with humorist Howard Moore, whose new book, How to Talk Minnesotan, is a collection of sketches he wrote for a Prairie Home Companion. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile the short-lived San Francisco group Love. It's part of his look back at the San Francisco rock scene 20 years ago. And book critic John Leonard will review Bruce Chatwin's homage to the culture of Australia's Aborigines. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is flugelhornist Art Farmer. New Yorker magazine jazz critic Whitney Balliot described Farmer as a gentle, highly melodic player whose style is spare, lyrical, logical. Farmer came of age just in time to play with the big bands before so many of them were wiped out by post-war musical and economic changes, but he really made his name playing bop and ballads in small groups. Farmer left America in the late 1960s when Europe seemed more hospitable to jazz musicians than America did. Since 1968, his primary home has been in Vienna, although he usually tours the States about half of each year. He's currently touring with composer and saxophonist Benny Golson. They recently reunited to create a new version of the Jazz Tet, the group they co-led in the 1960s. This is the opening of a ballad featuring Art Farmer from the Jazz Tet's most recent album, Back to the City. Flugelhornist Art Farmer. Farmer grew up in Phoenix. Before he finished high school, he left home for Los Angeles with his twin brother, the late bassist Addison Farmer. Art Farmer told me why he and his brother decided to drop out of high school and move to L.A.
Well, there was so much musical activity compared to Phoenix that it just seemed like just didn't make any sense to go back to Phoenix once I was in Los Angeles and I was exposed to Charlie Parker and Miles Davis and Howard McGee, people like that. And then I met Hampton Hawes and Eric Dolphy. We all were around the same age, and we were meeting and exchanging ideas and helping each other. And it was just something that I felt like it would be foolish to leave.
No, I understand that your grandmother was, I think, the first black woman or black person in Iowa to complete, was it college?
Yeah,
or
some sort of I think it was called normal school.
So I'm assuming that education was very important to your family.
Yes,
so
right.
How did your parents react when you were going to leave high school so that you could move to Los Angeles and be in the middle of the jazz scene there?
Well, my father had died when I was 4 years old, but my mother, she said, well, as long as you get your diploma from high school. So we were going to high school there, and at the high school we went to, the administration didn't know that we were just living there by ourselves. They thought we were living with our parents. So we would go to school, and when we didn't feel like going to school, well, then we would write an excuse and say, please excuse my son today because he was sick, or he had to do this, or had to do that. And this was for our last year. And what happened, I got this offer to go on the road with Johnny Otis' band, but the band was leaving about a month before the school was over, so I went to the principal, and I explained to him that this was my big break. But I asked him, since my record was good and my grades were good, could I could I still graduate with the class? And he said, okay. I said, well, would you put that in writing, please? Because by the time I get back here, you might not be here anymore. And I don't want to disappoint my mother. So he wrote this letter. He wrote a very nice letter. And in the letter, he said, if all the boys were as good as students as your boys were, then the school would be a much nicer school and blah, blah, blah. And he put that in the safe and gave me a copy of it. And I went back there maybe 10 or 15 years later. And I got my high school diploma. This was a school called Thomas Jefferson High School. And Dexter Gordon went to that same school. And trumpet player by the name of Arthur Walker, that used to play with Earl Hines, and Melba Liston went there. And quite a few people went there from time to time. And this was the first school that I know of that had what is now called a stage band. And we used to go around and play in other high schools in the Los Angeles area. And it was a great place for learning about music.
Were you ever able to thank the principal for doing that for you?
No, because when I went back, he was no longer there. He had moved on. So just what I thought would happen. He wasn't there. So if that hadn't been in the safe, I don't know if I'd ever gotten my high school diploma. It hasn't been any good to me since then. At least it rested my mother's mind.
That was really awfully savvy of you as a high school student to realize to get it in writing.
Yeah, well, I was traveling with Fast Company, you know. And, you know, like, you just have to think fast when you're traveling, when you're living on the edge that way. I know one time I took a job with a band, with Jimmy Mundy's band. Jimmy Mundy used to write for Earl Hines, and I think he was the composer of a song called I'm Traveling Light. Anyway, we got stranded someplace, and the guys in the... We were about 2 weeks behind in pay. So we were with some show, and the show ran out of money. So the guys decided that they were not going to play unless they got paid. So he says, well, if you don't play, then you get fired. So everybody got fired. You know, you have to get home the best way you can. So I went to him and I told him right off. I said, well, look, that goes for these other guys, but you can't do that to me. He says, why? And I said, because I'm a minor. I was only 16 years old, so he had to give me bus fare, you know. Well, those kind of things, you just have to, you do what you can think of, and that's it, you know. You get by.
That's great. Well, I want to play a record before we talk some more, and I thought, as we're talking about the past right now, we'd play one of your earlier sessions, and I think this is one of the first sessions that you led. I'm not sure about that. You can correct
well,
me on
it's,
that.
Well, it's probably near that. At this time, I was doing quite a bit of stuff for Prestige, but I must not have been under contract to Prestige, otherwise I wouldn't have been able to have done this at the time, since this was for Contemporary.
And this has recently been reissued. That's from the album Portrait of Art Farmer. The recording was made in 1958. We're going to hear you playing The Very Thought of You. And it's a really beautiful recording. Well, why don't we hear it, and then we'll talk about it. And this is Art Farmer, recorded in 1958, The Very Thought of You. Thank you. Art Farmer on trumpet is recorded in 1958, also featured with him Hank Jones at the piano, his late brother Addison Farmer on bass, and Roy Haynes on drums from the recently reissued album Portrait of Art Farmer. I have to say, I think your ballad playing is really just exquisite.
Thank you.
And I wonder how you sort of gravitating to ballads, because it's something really that a lot of bop players either don't do or don't do very well.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me like you have a chance to think when you're playing a ballad. That fast tempo is not pulling you along, so you can take time and really sort of sculpture the note just the way you want to get it. You know, you don't have to move on to the next thing until you're exactly ready to do it. And there must be some other reason than that, but I really can't think of what it is right now. I like to hear ballads played.
Me too.
I like to hear someone who can play one well. And at the time that I came up, well, the criterion of how good a player was how good he could play a ballad. You know, regardless of how much he was into with the fast stuff, you know, you take a guy like John Coltrane, for instance, well, it's always, yes, but can he play a ballad? And yes, John Coltrane can play a ballad. And Charlie Parker, yes, but can he play a ballad? Yes, Charlie Parker could play a ballad. You know, that's how they were judged by the older guys. You know, that's what they were. That's where you take your hat off.
Gee, you know, I'm almost surprised to hear that because I assume that that people would be really showing off how fast they could play a lick.
No, the older guys say, look, you have to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell a story, paint a picture. And that was the even Dizzy says that, you know, that's the whole thing.
Do you feel like you're telling a story when you play? Are you hearing the lyrics of a song or thinking
yeah.
of another
well,
story?
Well, I don't think of the lyrics verse by verse or line by line, but just the overall meaning of it. And it's very important. It's very important because, like, if I learn a song that's, a song that has lyrics in French or some other language, but then I feel like I really don't know the song until I know the meaning of these words. Yes, that's really important to me. And then it's just the overall thing. And I try to get that feeling, try to express that feeling that's been expressed in the words.
You mentioned before that when you and your brother moved to Los Angeles, you met a lot of musicians there, like Charlie Parker, Eric Dolphy, Hampton Hawes. Were they very influential to you? Because suddenly you had peers who were playing jazz. You were pretty isolated in Phoenix, and it doesn't sound like there was much of a jazz scene or a jazz community.
No, we were all influenced actually by the same. We were influenced by the people who had already found their thing. You know, like Bird and Miles and Dizzy. Those were the people that were influenced. Bud Powell and Monk and people like that. They'd already found their way, and they were the ones that were influencing us. And we were, at that time, we weren't really thinking about trying to find our own thing. We were just trying to play, more or less trying to imitate them at that particular time.
Did that work for you? At one point did you start thinking about finding your own voice?
Well, it seems like a gradual thing happened where you just sort of segue into your own voice. You don't just one day, at least when I say you, I mean me. I didn't just one day wake up and say, well, that's it, I'm going to go for myself. You know, it wasn't like that. It was just like over a period of time, you'd get an idea of, well, do this or do that, you know, and then it would wind up to be somewhere. You can always see where in hindsight, there were little deviations, because when I was first influenced as a jazz player, it was my main influences were Fats Navarro and Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie, and I would take from all of them, but I was eventually able to add a note here and there.
Did you like them personally?
Yeah, sure. I liked all three of them, and I still do.
Didn't Miles Davis used to rent your horn?
Yeah, he used to rent it.
Wait, was his in Hawk?
Yeah. At one time, he didn't have a horn, or he couldn't get to his horn, so he would rent mine, and he would rent. There used to be an, another guy. I can't remember his name right now. I used to use his horn. So a guy used to work for Prestige. But he would come by and want to take my horn, so I would go with him, you know, just for safety.
What would happen if you and Miles Davis both had a gig on the same night?
Oh, well, that happened, and he expected me to cancel my gig.
So you had to tell him no?
I told him no. I told him that I wasn't in the horn rent business, you know, but he's never at a loss for words. He really insisted. He said, look, man, I'm paying you for the horn. I said, yeah, but, you know, that's not my business. I want to play, too. You know, so you would think that he would say, yeah, well, I understand, sure. He said, man, I didn't know you were like that.
Why did you move to New York?
Well, I first came to New York in 1946. I came with Johnny Otis' band from California, and I got fired because I wasn't able to hold the chair. I was a self-taught trumpet player with bad habits, and I would use too much pressure and got a bad, big hole in my lip.
Literally a hole?
Yeah, and I couldn't play for a while. So I got fired from the job, and then I took a job in New York as a janitor in a theater in order to stay there and study. And that at that time, 52nd Street was in full bloom, and I used to go to the street and then stay there, you know, go there and sit in with Dizzy's band. And then when time came for me to go work, I'd pack the horn up and go and clean up the theater from 12 o'clock until 8 o'clock in the morning.
When you had these bad habits and it was really hurting your lips, so you had to take lessons and break those habits, were those habits hard to break?
Yeah, they're hard to break, right. Certainly, the best thing that a horn player can do is get a good foundation. But being starting to play in Phoenix, there was no one there. You know, I was brought up in, and this is one of the faults of segregation. I was brought up, I was studying in a segregated school. There were no teachers there, you know, and I didn't know of any teachers in the whole city. If you're not playing the right way, well, then you're going to pay for it.
How'd you deal with the frustration of knowing that you had to undo all the stuff that you'd taught yourself? Because it really is hard to create new habits and break old ones.
Well, I just knew it had to be done. If you have to do something, you have to do it. You know, I just thank God that I had some help, that there was somebody around who could tell me what to do.
So after that period of studying, then you reemerged as a better
right.
player and started playing with bands more?
Sure. I think sometimes it's better to have a problem than not to, because, like, if you never have a problem, well, you don't know what it's like. You don't put a value on the things that you do if you really have to work for them. So at this time I'm not complaining at all. I'm not bitter about anything like that. You know, that's all part of life. And I know that with many people, I've been playing now for as a professional for 40 years, and I know that there are many people who didn't have these problems, but they're not playing anymore. So since I had the rough time to go through, well, it sort of toughened me. And because I was tough and I've been able to survive a lot of other times, you know, and nothing is going to stop me from doing what I want to do.
What are some of the things that were hard to survive?
Well, it's hard to survive when you don't have any work and you don't know when you're going to get any work. And you feel, well, maybe I'm wasting my life. Maybe I should just find something else to put my energy to. You know, that's the hardest thing to survive. When you're not satisfied with what you're doing, and it seems like no one cares, no one really wants to hear what you're trying to do either, and there's no encouragement anyplace, you know. No one says, "Well, hang in there. It's got to get better." No one says that at a certain time. You know, you have to just hang in there.
Have there been times where, as much as you've loved the music you were playing, that you were disillusioned with the, quote, jazz life, with having to tour so much and, you know, live in trying circumstances?
No, the touring is nothing. That still doesn't bother me. I don't know. Jazz life, the only problem with the jazz life is having to work with shaky clubs, shaky promoters where you're subject not to get paid. Sometime, and then people, especially if you hired people and then you have to pay people and you don't get paired yourself with it. That's the only thing I don't like about it.
Has that happened a lot?
It happened. It usually happened. I mean, it used to happen. It hasn't happened in a while. But that would be the only thing I didn't like. You know, other than that, well, traveling doesn't bother me. That's just part of the work, part of the job.
My guest is flugelhornist Art Farmer. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is flugelhornist Art Farmer. When you were starting out in New York, you knew Lester Young there, right?
Yes.
He had this, I mean, not that I've ever heard him speak, but I've certainly read about it, and he had this kind of hip language of his own that he would use. Would you ever feel almost square by comparison because he was such the consummate hipster?
No, well, you see, in the environment, what would be called the jazz environment, there were ways of us talking to each other that so no one would know what we were talking about, for one reason or the other, with whatever there might be something that people shouldn't know what we were talking about, or maybe some things if it was money. Well, then I remember working with one band where the money was so little, we didn't want people to know what it was, you know. So if you ask someone, well, how much are we making tonight? If it was $20, which it wasn't, then they wouldn't say 20. They would say line 20. So if someone hears that, they would say, well, line 20. Well, that could mean like maybe that means 200 or 40 or who knows, you know. Well, but that was just one example. But Lester Young, he really carried out everything he said was like that. He never left that hardly. When he was just talking to us, he had his own way of talking, and we just had to figure out what he meant. If he said one lung, well, that would mean one course. You know, after you've been there for one night or two, you know his words. Half a lung, George Washington. If he says yetis, well, then that means leave it alone.
I guess you couldn't very well say, what exactly does that mean, Lester?
Well, that wouldn't be too hip, you know. You just sort of let it sink in.
For over 20 years now, your instrument has really been flugelhorn, which is subtly different from a trumpet in ways I will ask you to explain.
Well, it has a bigger sound. My first love is still the trumpet, but the sound that I was trying to get on the trumpet, I can get it more consistently on the flugelhorn. And every regardless of what note you play, it starts with the sound. And if I'm not satisfied with the sound that I hear in my own ears, then it sort of has a way of blocking my thinking. So I can't improvise that fluently unless I'm satisfied with the first sound. So I prefer to play the flugelhorn for improvisation. However, if I'm working with a big band in the trumpet section, then I take the trumpet out.
I noticed before that you were fidgeting with a mouthpiece.
Oh yeah.
Do you keep one in your pocket all the time?
No, but this one I don't leave it any place because the mouthpiece is the part that's closest to you and is irreplaceable. You can always find a horn. I would hate to lose the horn, but I would hate twice as much to lose the mouthpiece.
It sounds really odd considering the mouthpiece is this little thing
yeah.
And the horn is like the really expensive.
Yeah, that reminds
me.
That's the story. Like Nat Adderley was in New York. He used to live in New York, and one night he got robbed, and the people took his horn, you know, robbed on the street. They took his horn, took all of his money, and he told the guy, he said, look, man. Look, may I please ask you if you would just give me my mouthpiece? He said, I've been playing that mouthpiece ever since I've been playing. If you would please just give me the mouthpiece. And this guy said, what, you want the mouthpiece? Well, Oh, you want that old thing? Oh, take it. That ain't nothing. You can have it.
Story.
He was so glad to get it. He said, you can take the money, take the horn, but just give me the mouthpiece. Well, that's the way I feel. You know?
You and Benny Golson formed the Jazz Tat back in the late 50s.
Right.
And you've recently reunited and reformed a new version of that group. Are you glad that the Jazz Tat is back together?
Yes, I am glad, because this is the only group that I really have a chance to do any ensemble work with three horns. And Benny is certainly one of the foremost writers of all times. I couldn't be with a better person. What he writes is very challenging and very rewarding also to play.
After the Jazz Tet broke up, he moved to Los Angeles, and then a few years after that, you moved to Vienna.
Right.
Which is even further away from New York than Los Angeles is.
Yeah.
Why did you leave the States?
Well, I was invited to go over there to be a part of a international jazz competition organized by Friedrich Gulda, who was the pianist, the classical pianist and jazz player also. And this thing took about three or four weeks all in all. And during that time, I got to know some of the local musicians, and they told me there was a radio orchestra in the process of being organized and asked me if I would be interested in being a member of it. And if so, well, then I would have a lot of freedom. I would have security and freedom to do what I wanted to do. And it seemed to be a very good idea at the time, because at that particular time in the United States, the venues that I was able to play were very limited. I felt like I was in a real rut, and I was just going from one little joint to another, and with a lot of big empty spaces in between. So, and I'd been to Europe for a few times, and I find myself staying over there longer each time. So I decided, well, heck, why don't I just give it a try for a couple years? And that's how I happened to pick Vienna.
Art Farmer, it's really just been so great to meet you. Thank you
very much
for coming today.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been flugelhornist Art Farmer. My name is Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Gloria Steinem, a leading figure in the feminist movement and a founder of Ms. Magazine, so I hope you can join us. This is the Art Farmer Benny Golson Jazz Tet. Major funding for Fresh Air is made possible with a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, humorist Howard Moore will give us a quick lesson on talking Minnesotan. He wrote many of the sketches on A Prairie Home Companion that poked fun at Minnesota understatement, like the ads for Minnesota Language Systems and Raw Bits. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile Love, one of the wilder of the San Francisco groups that were playing 20 years ago this summer. And book critic John Leonard will review Songlines, Bruce Chatwin's ode to Aboriginal nomadic culture. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of the group Love, the first band to record the song Hey Joe. Love claimed British bands as their influence, but their own territory was California.
It was 1966, and along the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles, a social revolution was taking shape. At night, hordes of teenagers and college-age kids walked back and forth, stopping to talk, share joints, or try some moves on a member of the opposite sex. Others went dancing at Ciro's or The Trip, and in those clubs there were only two bands that mattered. One was The Byrds, and the other was Love.
Said goodbye. I thumbed right through my little red book. I wasn't gonna sit and cry. Then I went from A to Z. I took out every pretty girl in town. They danced with me. And as I held them, all I did was talk about you. Hear your name and I start to cry. There's just no getting over you.
Little Red Book was Love's first hit, the only one they didn't write. It was by Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who usually provided Dionne Warwick with more sedate material. But most of Love's songs were by Arthur Lee, a complex man who was one of the very few blacks on L.A.'s rock scene in those days. He was capable of holding this ragtag bunch of musicians together by the sheer force of his personality. The song Seven and Seven Is sounds a lot more like Love. It's weird.
When I was a boy, I thought a thousand times I'd be a man. I'd sit inside a bottle and pretend that I was in a can. In my lonely room, I set my mind in an ice cream cone. You can throw me if you want, because I'm a phone.
Two hits in a row literally went to the band's head, or sometimes into its veins, and by the time Elektra went looking for a follow-up to the band's first album, Da Capo, Love was no longer performing. But Elektra felt they owed Arthur Lee. He'd turned them on to another Sunset Strip band, The Doors, and the lawyers reminded them that Arthur owed Elektra, so engineer Bruce Botnick decided to get Arthur and some studio musicians together to record. After two songs, the band was shamed into wanting to play together again. At the end of 64 and a half hours, total cost $2,257, one of the strangest records of 1967, or any other year, was done. Love Forever Changes, it was called, and it featured titles like Maybe the People Would Be the Times, or Between Clark and Hilldale, and The Good Humor Man, He Sees Everything Like This, and A House Is Not a Motel. Live and Let Live, a stunning examination of power and violence, opens with one of the most shocking lines in popular music.
Oh, the snot has caked against my pants. It has turned into crystal. There's a bluebird sitting on a branch. I guess I'll take my pistol. I've got it in my hand. Because he's on my land. And so the story ended. You know it all so well. Oh, shit, you need, I'll tell you. The ending. And yes, I see you sitting on the couch. I recognize your artillery. I have seen you many times before. Once when I was in India, and I was on my land. Why can't you understand? And so the story ended. You know it all so well. Or should you need, I'll tell you the ending.
It was incendiary stuff, so much so that another line the band tossed off at the end of The Red Telephone became a rallying cry during the Sunset Strip riots. We're all normal and we want our freedom. Love made another couple of records, or rather Arthur did, but Forever Changes was really the end. Guitarist Brian McLean's little sister, Maria McKee, leads the band Lone Justice today, and Arthur still lives in L.A., but he doesn't write songs like this anymore.
Sitting on a hillside, watching all the people die. I'll feel much better on the other side of the world.
Songs like The Red Telephone lived on, and plenty of bands now claim Love as an influence. Forever Changes is still in print. Check it out, if you dare.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Minnesota humorist Howard Moore. Moore is not really from Minnesota. He grew up in Iowa, but he feels so at home in his adopted state that he's written a guidebook called How to Talk Minnesotan. The book is a spin-off from material he wrote and performed for the public radio series A Prairie Home Companion, hosted by Garrison Keillor. Moore is best known for such sketches as Raw Bits and the Minnesota Language Systems. Moore told me that there are three basic expressions I would need to know before visiting Minnesota. You bet, that's different, and whatever. So I asked him to show me how to use these in conversation.
Oh, sure. You bet is the catch-all phrase, catch-all Minnesotan phrase, and if you, when you come to Minnesota, you can use that as a reply to anything a Minnesotan might say to you.
What's an example of how I should use it?
Okay, well, somebody says, warm enough for you? You can say, you bet. Now, it may be warm enough for you or cold enough for you or whatever, but you can say, you bet. That's different is means you have more of an opinion. So, but you're not gonna give a lightning opinion, but it is a stronger opinion than you bet. And here are illustrations of that. With a couple of you bets thrown in for comparison. Two guys fishing. I suppose you use night crawlers for bullheads. You bet. What do you use? Stink bait. I make it out of rotten hamburger and moldy cheese with oatmeal for a binder. Well, that's different.
Now the only thing I have to do is learn how to use whatever, and I think I'm ready for a conversation.
Okay. All right, here's how you do that. Now, whatever actually expresses emotional turmoil of a certain kind, and only use it to express that sort of thing. Now, here's a man who's being told this. Your work is good, bud. We don't have any complaints, but we're going to have to let you go. It's the economy. Whatever. Or you can express resignation with it. Your electrician says to you, who's out at your house, I've been an electrician for 20 years, but I'll tell you, this house of yours is the worst I've ever seen. I'm surprised you didn't have real trouble long before now. I'm going to have to replace all the wiring. It ain't going to be cheap. Whatever. Now, if your wife tells you that her sister and brother-in-law are going to come and stay with you for a few months while they find themselves, you might say, you bet. Or you might say, that's different. But more than likely, you'd say, whatever.
I see you don't get too riled up when you learn to speak like a Minnesotan.
You shouldn't. You shouldn't take off and start having a lot of ups and downs in your voices and talking at the top of your voice. When you come out east and you're a Minnesotan, the way I am, I try to speed up and put a little more magic into my voice. Maybe you've noticed that.
You're doing that now. I thought it sounded kind of magical, but I wasn't really sure. Now, once someone learns how to talk Minnesotan, you make it seem that what they should talk about is the weather or maybe cars.
My feeling is that the cars are top, and you can get a Minnesotan talking about cars when you can't get them talking about anything else. I'm not too interested in fashions, for instance, or game shows, but you mention a car like say, my 1970 Chrysler, and a Minnesotan could go on and on about how it had one carburetor on it and tightened the nut down on it too much, and it warped the carburetor and had to have another one on it, and the gas mileage kind of dropped. Or he could go on and on about the time he took the Chrysler and made a wrong turn, thought it was a road. It was a farmer's lane. He went right in, turned left into a cow lot, and the liquid refuse from the cows was about a foot deep, and it was either gun it or stop right in the middle and wade out. And he gunned it and covered the engine and every part of the car with about an inch of the stuff that comes from cows. And so when he would take the car to town after that, it would people wouldn't park too near it.
I'm supposed to say, that's different. How did
yes,
I do?
It that's good. No, okay. That's good. That's good. You didn't have too much emotion in your voice, and I like that.
Good, good. Where are you from, Howard?
Well, I know when people say that, they want to know where.
Yes.
They want to know where you're born, and I've lived in Minnesota 17 years, but I was born in Des Moines, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Did you experience any kind of culture shock when you came to Minnesota? Did you feel different or out of place, not part of the culture?
No, I actually didn't. When I drove across the border and we bought our little farm place, I knew it was home. I actually did. I'm not just making that up. I must have been a Minnesotan all my life.
You joined up with a Prairie Home Companion before it went national. How did you become part of the program?
I was on one of the shows that Garrison used to take out traveling. And he would do gyms and theaters and so forth. And I was connected with, I'd been doing a little performing with another group called Poetry Out Loud. And so I was on his traveling show, and one thing led to another. That was in 1976. And I just, I was invited back to be on the show to read my material more and more. And eventually when Garrison got so busy writing his book and the show went national, he and I started writing together. Sort of collaborating, and then pretty soon we didn't collaborate so much. I wrote stuff, and he'd look at it and he'd say, yeah, let's do this, or let's do this, or take that line out there, it's great, or whatever. And I would work on scripts, send them up by special delivery about Wednesday. We'd talk about them a little bit on Thursday. I'd call him on Friday and say, what are you going to use? Are you going to use the stuff with me in it? Should I come up? He'd say, yeah, come up, I'll see you tomorrow. I'd get in the car on Saturday morning and drive to his house and mess around with the processor for a while, and we'd go down to the theater about 3:30 and do what amounted to a rehearsal. The stuff between Garrison and me often wasn't rehearsed, like the Walleye Phone, the Bob Humdies. We would just go out and do it cold.
How did you come up with the Raw Bits cereal advertisements? Is there a kind of cereal or a kind of consumer of that cereal that you had in mind?
Well, what made me think of it was, and I mean, everybody has noticed that almost from the beginning of cereals, heroes, sports figures, people who are on top have been used as the spokespeople for the cereal. And what I did was just reverse it. Let me read you one of the testimonies, shall I?
Oh, please.
For Raw Bits. The tough natural cereal made from oat hulls and wheat chaff. Here's a testimony. I never wear new clothes in public because people can always tell when you got new clothes on. I've been sensitive about it ever since my mother forgot to take the price tag off my new J.C. Penney shirt in fourth grade, and the whole class laughed at me, and my nickname was 298 Small until I graduated from high school. Now when I buy clothes as an adult, I wear them around the house until they look old. Then I'm safe from public humiliation. My cereal, Raw Bits. It already looks old when you buy it.
Yeah, you really turn those celebrity testimonials on their head.
Right. And it's a natural cereal, and it's not sold in stores, and it's by invitation only, and it goes against all the commercial aspects. They don't have a cartoon show, for instance, the Raw Bits Company, and really the president of the company doesn't care whether you eat a cereal or not, and he doesn't want just anybody eating it, it turns out. Excuse me, go ahead.
You always say that the pause is the heartbeat of a Minnesotan's conversation. I seem to just be jumping into those pauses.
Well, I
proving that you're right and that I'm an Easterner.
Well, I ran into trouble doing live radio with Garrison, too. A couple of times we just went out and did spots with no script at all and no idea where we were going. And he usually had to fill in the pauses. He would occasionally say, "Howard, actually, you're supposed to say something here," until I did. So,
you sorry that the show has ended?
Oh, sure, but I'm glad. You know, whatever Garrison said about not going on too long is great, because somebody has already compared it to the long-running TV series that one of my favorites, you know, MASH. And they deliberately cut that one. They said, "This is it. We're going to stop now." And they stopped when they had a nice package of great shows. And I think there's plenty of reruns in A Prairie Home Companion.
What are your plans now that A Prairie Home Companion live broadcasts are finished?
Well, I'm out promoting this book this summer. And then I'll start on another book or two. They keep pressing me there at Penguin to do that. And whatever comes by, I'll do. I'll keep writing. I'll look for a radio. I'll look for a good radio show, too.
Howard Moore's new book is called How to Talk Minnesotan. The Butch Thompson Trio playing Scott Joplin on Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
How's your coverage shaping up on today's Iran-Contra hearings?
Well, we'll have a report on Admiral Poindexter, the former National Security Advisor's last day, we believe, on the witness stand. Also, we will be having reports about a visit to the Hill to testify by Elliot Abrams, man of figures in all this, Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, and also a report on a hearing about possible drug trafficking involvement in Central America.
What else do you have for us?
Well, we have stories about the reflagging of the Kuwaiti tankers, which began today, as there are now two ships bearing American flags that used to be Kuwaiti ships headed for the Persian Gulf.
Okay, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bruce Chatwin's new book, The Songlines, is based on his travels to Australia. He explores the rituals of the Aborigines and links their ways to his own theories about human nature. Critic John Leonard has this review.
Bruce Chatwin is one of those brilliant young Englishmen who won't stay home. His itch to go is metaphysical as well as geographical. He wants big answers. In his first book, he went to Patagonia to find not only the usual penguins and sandworms, but also Charles Darwin and Caliban and the inventor of the mobile gas oven that became so popular in Nazi Germany. In other words, he found evil. His second book, The Viceroy of Ouida, started out as a meditation on the African slave trade. But in a middle passage of horned vipers, bloody goats, and severed heads, it became a kind of hallucination about sadomasochism, a sort of imperialist pornography. He tried to stay home for his third book, On the Black Hill, about twins in the border country between England and Wales, but ended up writing instead about class warfare, Freud, and the flight of the soul from the 20th century. Now, in Songlines, he reinvents Australia. Under a ghost gum tree, attended by dingoes and bush devils and black cockatoos, he will answer what he calls the question of questions, the nature of man's restlessness. He wants to know the Aboriginals because they specialize in the same thing he does, the walkabout. They just pick up and disappear. Why and where to? Well, all of Australia is a labyrinth of invisible pathways, dreaming tracks or song lines, known to Aboriginals as the footprints of the ancestors. Aboriginal creation myths tell of legendary totemic beings who wandered over the continent in dreamtime, singing out the name of every bird, animal, plant, and rock, and so singing the world into existence. If you don't hit the road and sing, the world will vanish. This is nifty. In other words, you can read the whole of Australia as a musical score. Visualize, says Chatwin, the song lines as a spaghetti of Iliads and Odysseys. And before our eyes, on these pages, Chatwin sings the land and its people to dazzling life. But of course he wants more. He wants ancient Greek and Hebrew, Old Norse, Old English, and all of classical mythology to be gigantic song maps, too. A nomad at heart, and thus at home among the Aboriginals, he thinks agriculture itself was a bad idea, and that the whole point of our big brain is, quote, for singing our way through the wilderness. The noble savage is his kind of guy. Thus he refuses to believe that we began as killers of our own kind on the African savanna. He prefers to think that in our nomadic origins we were acquainted only with the voluntary graces, language, song-making, food-sharing, gift-giving, intermarriage. We must have developed weapons just to fight off a prehistoric beast, half-saber-toothed tiger, half-prince of darkness, a cave killer that haunts our unconscious to this day. Here Chatwin descends into sloppy argument and wishful thinking and perhaps naivete as he tries to pick and choose among bickering ethologists and paleontologists, all those desert-crazed monomaniacs who dream the past on an ice age toenail or a tooth. But until then, it's a lovely, lovely walkabout in the wondrous.
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Bruce Chatwin's new book, The Songlines. Here's a preview of tomorrow's program. On our next show, I'll speak with pianist and singer Bob Durow. He co-wrote the song I'm Hip, wrote Blue Christmas for Miles Davis, and composed songs for the TV series Schoolhouse Rock. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review Peter Sellers' controversial staging of Mozart's Don Giovanni. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will answer the question, what do linguists really do anyways? So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's show is produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Lisa Bruton. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.